Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. During the workshop, you will hear from our panel of expert speakers. We will allow time for questions and comments following the presentation. Instructions will be given at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star, then zero on your touchtone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Ms. Johnny Nazarian, Education Program Manager at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Thank you so much, Bella, and I too would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Care Connect Education Workshop titled Treatment Update on Oral Head and Neck Cancer. In this program, we are doing it in partnership with the Head and Neck Cancer Alliance, and you'll be hearing from them later on in the workshop today. Also, this program is supported by Becerra Therapeutics and an educational grant from Johnson & Johnson. I really want to thank them for their support of today's program. Now to start, I just want to let you know how many people we have on the call. We have over 200 participants, primarily from the United States, from rural, urban, suburban, and frontier communities. We also have a number of international participants from Canada, China, Ghana, and the Philippines, so it is a global call. We are delighted to have you all on this program today and that you've chosen to spend this next hour with us. And now I'm going to introduce our first speaker. And our first speaker is Dr. Terry Day. And Dr. Day is National Director, Head and Neck Oncology at Sarah Cannon Cancer Network, Head and Neck Specialist Sarah Cannon. And Dr. Day will be discussing an overview of oral head and neck cancer, including staging and diagnosing, surgical interventions, including plastic and reconstructive surgery, the difference between HPV-positive and HPV-negative head and neck cancer diagnoses, guidelines and tips for the care of your teeth, gums, and mouth, speech and swallowing rehabilitation, and lastly, the importance of communicating with your healthcare team, key questions to ask about your quality of life concerns. It is now my great pleasure to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Day.
Thank you very much, Johnny. It's just a pleasure to be back with Cancer Care again, and I'd like to extend our gratitude not just to Cancer Care, but also our distinguished panelists and the generous sponsors who make educational events like this possible for our patients and also the families who walk alongside them every step of the way. Today, as you just heard, we're going to cover a lot of ground, what oral and head and neck cancer is, and how surgery, including reconstructive surgery, plays a role in the treatment, why dental care matters more than many people realize, and how speech and swallowing therapy can be a game changer for quality of life. I'll also give patients and family members some important questions you should be asking of your medical team. Since I am a head and neck surgeon, I'm not a dentist or a speech pathologist. I have engaged my colleagues, Dr. Michelle Roos in dental oncology and maxillofacial prosthodontics, Dr. Ricardo Padilla in oral and maxillofacial pathology, and Hannah Walton in speech and swallowing therapy. And so I'll be speaking on their behalf based upon their expertise that they've provided to me. So first, we'll start with an overview of head and neck cancer, and it's not a one-size-fits-all disease. It's a very complex category that demands a team, not just one doctor, but a whole constellation of specialists working in concert. Now, we're talking about experts in chemotherapy, immunotherapy, radiation therapy, surgery, reconstruction, dental oncology, speech pathology, maxillofacial prosthodontics, nutrition, nursing, radiology, pathology, psychology, endocrinology, palliative care, social work, survivorship, and clinical trials. And so it's very important that people understand that this requires multidisciplinary team collaboration to provide optimal care. If that list surprises you, it shouldn't. This disease touches nearly every aspect of a person's life, and the care team needs to reflect that. So to make things easier to understand, we will simplify today's discussion on three main categories of head and neck cancer. Although there's many more, we're going to talk about mouth cancer, throat cancer, and voice box cancer. And these are cancers of the lining of the head and neck area. And I'll talk to you a little bit about each cancer just briefly, and then we'll go more in depth as we go along. So mouth cancers are also called oral cancers, not oropharyngeal. Don't get the names interchanged. Mouth cancers typically appear inside the mouth as a red or white patch that doesn't heal. A dentist or physician can often see these in the office. The highest risk factors are tobacco use and alcohol for the mouth cancers. Now, how are they diagnosed? Usually if there's a red or white patch that doesn't heal, a biopsy is performed. Sometimes, like in the oropharyngeal cancers, the first thing someone might notice is a swollen lymph node or gland in the neck, and that should be evaluated by a specialist, at which time a needle biopsy can often be done to diagnose these. Many times people will get a CAT scan also to further evaluate what is going on or causing the problems. So let's go to part two, the throat cancers or pharyngeal cancers. These develop behind the mouth in areas like the base of the tongue or tonsils where they can't always be seen with special equipment. One of the first signs is an enlarged lymph node on one side of the neck. The primary cause of oropharyngeal cancer in today's world is HPV or human papillomavirus. The hopeful part is that there is a vaccine for these. It should be offered to boys and girls and men and women up to age 45 and has been shown to prevent oropharyngeal cancers and cervical cancers. Other less common oropharyngeal cancers are what we call HPV negative or non-viral associated, and these are typically from tobacco use and often present to the clinic with a sore throat that doesn't go away, a lump in the back of the throat, or pain and bleeding in the back of the throat. The third part is voice box cancers or laryngeal cancers, and these can often only be seen with a lighted camera or endoscope. The most common warning sign is hoarseness that will not go away. So if somebody's voice changes and it's not getting better, especially if they're tobacco users, they should be evaluated by a specialist. There are many other cancers of the salivary glands and thyroid and skin that we're not going to have time to cover today, unfortunately. So let's move into surgical interventions, including plastic and reconstructive surgery. Many of these patients, an operation or surgery is part of the journey, and understanding what that means can help reduce fear and help with decision making. The surgery is intended to remove all of the cancers. Oftentimes, the lymph nodes might need to be removed as well. Whenever a part of the mouth or throat or neck is removed, sometimes reconstruction is necessary, and I'll go into that. So let's start with mouth cancers. Surgery is the gold standard treatment for mouth cancers and has proven more effective than chemotherapy or radiation alone for achieving a cure. When the disease is more advanced, like a stage 3 or 4, surgery is typically followed by radiation to eliminate any remaining microscopic cancer cells and or prevent any other cells from developing into cancer. Now, for throat cancers or oropharyngeal cancers. Okay, thank you. I'm sorry there was a disconnection. From what I understand, we were finishing up on the HPV negative treatment and diagnosis. I apologize. That's the first time that's happened. I've done this for over 10 years. So we will finish up on the HPV negative. These can be treated with surgery or radiation for the early stage, but often need combined modality treatment with surgery followed by radiation or chemo radiation together in the advanced stage 3 and 4. Now, moving on to voice box cancers, these also, like the oropharyngeal cancers, can be treated in early stage with surgery or radiation very effectively. Oftentimes, radiation alone provides the patient a better quality of life
in voice and swallowing than surgery alone. However, in advanced stage, again, it's combined modality with either surgery followed by radiation or combined radiation with chemotherapy. Now, in the surgery component for all these cancers, the key part is clean margins. Now, that means all of the edges around the cancer are clear of cancer and no cancer is left behind. So when a tumor is removed, the goal is to take it out completely and not leave any cancer cells at the edges. And the pathologist examines that in real time at the time of surgery. Also, whenever there's a potential for spread to lymph nodes in that vicinity are typically removed at the same time as the removal of the cancer. Now, here's another aspect where modern medicine has truly inspired all, reconstructive surgery. Over the past several decades, head and neck reconstruction has been transformed. Head and neck surgeons can now take tissue, muscle, skin, nerves, blood vessels, and even bone from a patient's own leg, arm, or back and use it to rebuild the face, the jaw, the mouth, the tongue, or the throat or the voice box. If part of the tongue, jaw, or throat is removed, reconstruction can often improve the ability to speak, chew, eat, swallow, and also improve cosmesis way better than decades ago. And in the field of maxillofacial prosthetics, 3D modeling technology is now being used to create a custom, precise, artificial ear, nose, eye, and dental implants, which can be done right at the time of surgery and include teeth in a day or jaw in a day or eye in a day, so that if an organ is removed, a prosthetic and or implants can be placed at the same time. Ask your doctors about these options. Now, I'm going to go next into protecting what matters, a guide to oral care during head and neck cancer treatment. This is from Dr. Michelle Roos, DDS, MDS, FACP. And it is very important that people understand, and they are often surprised, that one of the most important members of your head and neck cancer team is not your surgeon or radiation oncologist. It's the dentist and speech therapist. These are the people that are crucial in improving quality of life and overall outcomes. So what we're talking about is that surgery and radiation can have significant negative impacts on the mouth, the taste, the saliva, the mucus. And if you're a patient or caregiver, I want you to leave this conversation with a clear understanding that dental care isn't optional, it's essential. And if you're a clinician, please reinforce to the patients the evidence-based and clinical decision points that can genuinely change outcomes for your patients. So radiation can cause damage to the saliva glands, the mucus, the teeth, the jawbone, and have a significant impact on outcomes. What are these? And I'll list them here. There's six of them. Mucositis, inflammation of the lining of the mouth and throat. Taste changes due to the impact on taste buds and salivary glands. Trismus, which is a tightening or restriction of the jaw muscles or jaw opening, and pain when you open your mouth. Fourth is xerostomia or dry mouth. Fifth is dental caries, damage to the teeth from radiation. And sixth, and this is one that can be very serious and sometimes life-threatening, is osteoradionecrosis or ORN. And all of these can be prevented and can also be improved upon with your dental oncologist, prosthodontist, periodontist, and your primary dentist. So the important part is to understand that every patient and caregiver should take heart to. These complications are not inevitable. They're manageable and in many cases preventable. And if they do occur after the fact, they can be improved upon. There's many different options and devices and treatments, including oral positioning devices to keep the radiation from damaging certain areas. Prescription strength fluoride is a non-negotiable part for head and neck cancer radiation, pre-radiation dental extractions, dental cleanings every 3 months, and trismus appliances and therapy. So really, a word to patients and families, if you remember one thing from today from the dental world, please see a dental specialist before you start radiation, not after. Please do it before and have them a part of your treatment plan and also see them during and after the treatment. So head and neck cancer is a very complex journey. Having the dental oncologist and the speech therapist are crucial. And that's going to lead me to the next to last part. And it's finding your voice and swallowing again, speech and swallowing rehabilitation in head and neck cancer. This is from Hannah Cornett Walton, CCC, SLP, MS, and BCS. Amazing person that specializes in head and neck cancer speech and swallowing outcomes. So eating a meal with your family or going out to a restaurant or attending a party, calling a friend on the phone, saying good morning. These are things everybody takes for granted until you can't do it. And head and neck cancer and treatments can sometimes cause damage from the cancer treatment that impacts speaking, swallowing, chewing, and breathing. And when these are disrupted, it doesn't just affect the body. It can affect identity, connection, and quality of life. And so that's why an SLP, or speech language pathologist, is a core part of every head and neck cancer team. So I'd like to take you through the first part, which is swallowing. It's called dysphagia, the clinical term for difficulty swallowing, and it's one of the most common and consequential effects of head and neck cancer treatment. It's far more complex than it appears and involves all of the muscles in the throat that may be impacted from either surgical removal or radiation damage. And it's important that the speech therapist is involved before and during and after treatment. So there's many warning signs: coughing, excess mucus, choking, change in ability to swallow a certain food, and even can impact breathing. So it's important to understand that a speech and swallowing therapist can really make a difference in improving these outcomes. There's many diagnostic tools that they use. One is called a modified barium swallow study that uses real-time X-ray imaging with the patient swallowing small amounts of barium-coated food and liquid. So the exact pinpoint problem of where the problem with speech or swallowing is can be identified. Also, FEES, or fiber optic endoscopic evaluation of swallowing, uses a thin, flexible camera passed through the nose to view the eating and drinking mechanism real time on a video screen. These are safe, informative, and guide the treatment decisions. So what about making it better? Rehabilitation, building safety, efficiency, and quality of life. Once the swallow is understood, then the goals can be pursued on improving the outcomes and getting the swallowing and speech back to normal. And that may require very consecutive examinations and evaluations with a specialist in head and neck SLP. So compensatory strategies can be described and taught. People can do these at home. They don't have to keep making return visits. And then periodic visits can evaluate their success. So the speech and swallowing are important parts. The voice is categorized differently. And that's the other part. When surgery may remove part of the voice or part of the articulation of the tongue, the voice box. And so the speech therapist can work on this. Many people have heard of a total laryngectomy, which is removal of the entire voice box. And believe it or not, without a voice box, there's actually three ways to learn to talk again. And those can be taught by a speech and swallowing therapist. It's called alaryngeal speech. So in closing, from a speech and swallowing perspective, it's really important, and it's all about helping patients return to what matters most to them. For some, it's sharing the meal with people they love. Other, it's getting on the phone with their kids or grandkids, and they want to feel safe and confident about going out to eat in public. So lastly, we have just a few questions that you should have for your treatment team. And I'm going to break these down by the cancers. Oral cancer or mouth cancer, you want to ask, how will you know if the margins are clear and all the cancers removed? Another is, will my lymph nodes need to be removed or treated? Will I need radiation? Don't forget to ask, in all cancers, can I see a dentist and speech therapist before starting treatment? Lastly, for mouth cancer, what type of reconstruction will be done and how will it affect my appearance and function if I undergo surgery? The another important part for all cancers is what types of CAT scans or PET scans or imaging will be done to evaluate the cancer and the stage and if it is spread or not. Now, when we get to oropharyngeal cancer, this can be, again, HPV positive or HPV negative. For the HPV positive cancers, they have a different staging system and they can be monitored differently. They also may be treated differently. You want to ask, has my cancer been tested for HPV? Also, is the lymph node HPV positive or negative if you have a biopsy of the lymph node? How will my treatment affect my speech, swallowing, and saliva production? And if they're talking about either doing radiation or surgery, which one will afford me the best quality of life and getting back to my hobbies or work? Lastly, in larynx cancer, what impact will the treatment have on my quality of life, in specifically my voice and my ability to swallow? How will you monitor whether or not the cancer is cured? And what exercises should I be doing to protect those functions with a speech and swallowing therapist? And finally, for all cancers, don't forget to ask what stage it is and if your case will be presented at a multidisciplinary head and neck tumor board where specialists review it all together and what support team is available. If the cancer is spread, please ask, are there any clinical trials that might help me get through my cancer treatment? So I'm apologize for getting cut off earlier. Thanks to all the presenters today and participants, and I hope this was helpful. And we will have some handouts to send out via email. So thanks so much and appreciate the opportunity to present today.
Great. Thank you so much, Dr. Day, for an incredible presentation. Like you said, you covered a lot of information. I do want to extend my thanks to your colleagues, Dr. Michelle Roos and Hannah Cornett-Walton. As Dr. Day mentioned, we do have resources specifically pertaining to this presentation today. So please do not feel as if this live workshop is your only opportunity. We have them now on the webcast and then we will send them out later so you can receive them later on after we have them available here for you. Okay, and now I'm going to introduce our next speaker. And our next speaker is Dr. Christoph Maisukowicz. And Dr. Maisukowicz is Associate Professor of Medicine, Hematology, and Medical Oncology, Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai, Clinical Director of Research in Head and Neck, Clinical Director of the Center for Personalized Cancer Therapeutics, CPCT, the Tisch Cancer Institute, and Chairman of the Oncology Pharmacy and Therapeutics Committee. And Dr. Maisukowicz will be discussing new chemotherapy options, concurrent chemotherapy, and radiotherapy, key questions in making treatment decisions, the role of clinical trials, how research increases your treatment options, managing side effects, symptoms, discomfort, and pain, as well as guidelines to prepare for telehealth/telemedicine appointments, including technology prepared lists of questions and discussion of open notes. It is now my great pleasure to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Maisukowicz.
So good afternoon, everybody. So I'm speaking from New York City, so it's afternoon. So welcome everybody. It's an absolute honor to be part of this panel, and it has been a long journey for me as other speakers to do it again, so thank you so much. So as I was already introduced, I'm going to be covering the chemotherapy or immunotherapy options for head and neck cancer. I'm going to be discussing them. For the purpose of the discussion, I'm going to be simplifying things, but make it easier to kind of understand. And sometimes I'm going to be using some kind of metaphors to kind of present the foundation of we're going to be going into this discussion and kind of understand the cancer biology better. So the first thing I want to say that and locally or potentially curable head and neck cancer, many times those patients are seen by the surgeon that was discussed before, and the surgical option is being discussed. And I always say to my patients when they see me after such, I like to compare the cancer to like a weed in the garden. So basically when you get a weed, you get a shovel, you dig it out, and you want to remove everything. You want to remove all the roots. But the challenge sometimes is that sometimes you're not sure if you got all the roots, because even if I'm going to give you the magnifying glass and I'm going to say, check your garden, check your grass, are you sure you got everything? Sometimes it's impossible to say. So this is the foundation. And historically, most of the head and neck cancer patients, most of them, not all of them, they were treated by surgeons up front because, you know, the mass was potentially resectable. And many times those patients, they had to wait, not because there's some kind of a clause in the system, 5 weeks until they have a surgery done, because you have to schedule the operating room and you have to get the clearance and etc. And the question always became that, can we do something as the patient is waiting, and maybe there's actual benefit of this? And actually there was a study that changed the whole landscape of how we treat head and neck cancer patients, because the study basically what it did, they offered immunotherapy. So this is a intravenously, or now it can be given subcutaneously, medication that can be given twice, or actually sometimes once, prior to surgery every 3 weeks. This is how it was in the study. And then subsequently, those patients went for the surgery. The standard arm of the study was there was no immunotherapy, and those patients were just waiting for the surgery to happen, and then the surgery was done. Subsequently, what was happening to those patients, as I used the first metaphor, that if the surgeon was absolutely confident that the entire cancer was removed, there is no leftover, some of those patients, they don't need anything. If the surgeon was semi kind of confident with the success and the pathologist with the surgery, those patients were labeled as a low risk for recurrence. Those patients were treated with radiation alone. And eventually, if it was really high risk, those patients were treated with the chemotherapy and radiation. And the question of the study was, can the immunotherapy that can be offered before the surgery can change outcome of the patient? And I would say from the surgical perspective, the question was, as this immunotherapy was requested to give to our patient, was, can we shrink the cancer? Can we maybe kill some portion of this cancer as we're giving immunotherapy? And can we actually help those patients? And this is the study called KEYNOTE-689 with the medication called Keytruda or pembrolizumab. And the outcome of the study was that the patient that instead of going straight for the surgery with the stage 3 or 4 locally advanced head and neck cancer, they were offered immunotherapy prior to surgery, those patients, they did better. So I would say in my clinical practice, I would even say that almost 100% of the patients that the surgeons they see, they always ask me if this patient would benefit from the immunotherapy that we see given prior. And how it is done, you give immunotherapy, you repeat the scan, you still determine the resectability of the cancer, those patients undergo the surgery, and the second part of the study was if there is any benefit of addition of immunotherapy that can be due to the standard of care. So as an example, if currently we're treating patients with radiation alone, can we add immunotherapy to radiation alone? If the patient currently was treated with chemotherapy and radiation, can we add immunotherapy to those patients? And as it was done, the patients that for which the immunotherapy was added, they did much better than the ones they didn't. So I would say the current standard most of the time is that we offer our patients before the surgical resection an immunotherapy that is minimally toxic. Subsequently, those patients, they undergo the surgical resection, and eventually the subsequent treatment is determined which if it's going to be radiation plus immunotherapy or chemotherapy and radiation and immunotherapy is given to those patients. So this is really practice-changing approach to this patient. The second study that was done, because some of the patients, they already underwent the surgery, right? But they sometimes it's required, and the question is, can they still benefit from the immunotherapy? And the study is called NIVOSTOP, and in this study, all the patients that were labeled as high risk, meaning there's a high risk for the cancer to come back, can they benefit that of addition of immunotherapy that's going to be added to chemotherapy and radiation, if they're going to benefit and they're going to do better? And actually, this study showed there is a benefit of this. To kind of summarize this, so basically, as the immunotherapy couple of years ago was not existent or not indicated in head and neck cancer patients, now obviously we use it, and I think there's a clear benefit, whether the surgery already took place or surgery is about to take place. Again, all the patients or most of the patients should be evaluated by medical oncologists prior to surgery to determine if there is any benefit of immunotherapy that can make the surgery easier and there is a clinical benefit. Having this in mind, something that I would just want to discuss, that as immunotherapy is given, the question now remains, can we improve the outcome or can we shrink the cancer even more by making this treatment more effective? And as of now, there are multiple clinical trials and they're looking into the option of seeing if adding chemotherapy to immunotherapy, if it's going to shrink the cancer even more, or it can even kill the cancer before it's resected even more. And the outcome of those clinical trials or small studies is so positive that there is an overall trend, I would say, in many institutions to offer. And again, in the form of a clinical trial of a combination treatment for selected patients to kind of improve the outcome of those patients. And that's why I would encourage all the patients to even ask or inquire about the clinical trial, because ultimately they can benefit from those treatments. So now I'm going to pause and then I'm going to move to recurrent metastatic cancer, where the treatment currently is either immunotherapy alone or it's a combination of chemotherapy and immunotherapy. And obviously, even though those treatments are effective, we want to make it better. And I would say there are currently four clinical trials that are looking into improvement of this treatment. So for patients for which we just give immunotherapy along with Keytruda, which is the current standard, the question is, can we add the second medication to Keytruda and improve the outcome of the patients with recurrent or metastatic head and neck cancer patients? And there are quite a few options. So I would say most of the patients should be able to find the appropriate clinical trial for a situation like this. One of the medications that is being tested in clinical trials, it's called Tisavastatin Alpha. So I know those are the difficult names. The company that manufactures this drug is called Bicara. So you can ask for the Bicara clinical trial or Tisavastatin Alpha clinical trial. And in those clinical trials, patients are being offered this investigational drug in addition to standard immunotherapy. And from the previous study that was done on the small number of patients, this combination looks extremely promising and is offered for recurrent metastatic HPV negative patients. So I would encourage you to ask for this clinical trial. But what about other clinical trials that are also present? So the other medication called petosudimab, a drug that is manufactured by a company called Nereus, has similar design, but it's offered for HPV positive and HPV negative recurrent metastatic patients. And the outcome of the preliminary study is also very promising. And obviously, we don't know if the first one is better than the second or second is better than the one. This is something that eventually may be determined later on. But regardless, I think all those clinical trials, they offer a very promising treatment option. And again, this is a combination of the investigational drug with the current standard, which is Keytruda. And I would strongly encourage you, because both combinations are minimally toxic, so they, I think, much better than chemotherapy because of the toxicity profile. And they offer now very promising results that I hope, obviously, is going to be proven in the larger studies. For other patients, let's say with the HPV positive, there is another clinical trial with the medication called PDS1-0101. So this is sort of like a vaccine therapy that is given with the combination of also immunotherapy for only HPV positive patients. And in theory is that this vaccine makes the cancer more visible to the immune system and is also promising. And the last one is with the medication called avitamimab that is offered with chemotherapy and also seems to be more promising than the current standard. So to kind of summarize, I have to say that I have been given this talk and this presentation many, many, many times, and I cannot recall that I have ever had a chance to offer almost 4 clinical trials that are equally effective and equally promising to the audience. So I would say definitely, I think most of the patients, they should ask about the clinical trial participation. Then I'm going to move to the side effects and how we can handle them. I have to admit that as we, especially in recurrent metastatic settings, we're moving away from giving chemotherapy. And again, chemotherapy has some role in the treatment of recurrent and metastatic head and neck cancer patients, but many times it's replaced by immunotherapy that is minimally toxic or eventually clinical trials that I mentioned. So most of the time I tell my patients if there is any complaint that is new, that is completely different how they felt before, you should call your doctor and ask them if it's related to the drug that is given. And even the ones that are minimally toxic, unfortunately, sometimes can cause some problems and the medical team should be notified. And I think the current technology gives us some other opportunities how we can communicate with our doctors. And one of them is the televisit. The other one that is, there are some chats like Epic Chat that you can send the message directly to your medical team and you can get the answer how to handle it. Some of those side effects can be managed over the phone. Some of them that require the in-person visit and the clinician has to evaluate it. But most of the time, I have to say that side effects that are related to the immunotherapy that kind of dominated how we treat our patients can be easily managed and those patients are going to be quickly addressed. So as a summary, as the keynote, I just want to say there's lots of things happening in the locally advanced and metastatic head and neck cancer patients. I would strongly encourage you to participate in clinical trials because those clinical trials and the new treatment options, they look so promising. And obviously, we still have to test them, that I think your participation not only is going to best benefit the science, but may significantly benefit you. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Dr. Meisugwitz, for, again, another wonderful presentation today. You provided a lot of information, especially pertaining to clinical trials, so I know that there will be questions for you during the Q&A. Thank you so much. Okay, and our next speaker is Ms. Diana Bearden. And Ms. Bearden is an oncology dietitian at the Michael E. DeBakey VA Medical Center. And Ms. Bearden will be discussing nutrition and hydration concerns and tips. It is now my great pleasure to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Ms. Diana Bearden.
Thank you so much. I'm excited to be part of today's presentation. Nutrition and hydration are essential, not only in your tolerance to treatment, but for your quality of life. Your diet might be modified during and after your cancer treatment just to assist with you meeting your nutrition goals. Now, some possible side effects that can happen from treatment include things such as loss of taste or changes in your taste, dry mouth, a decreased appetite, maybe nausea, vomiting, a thicker saliva, a sore throat, maybe difficulties swallowing, and maybe difficulties chewing due to needed dental extractions. There might be some pain with swallowing and some challenges with weight loss. But each person's response to treatment is different. And we need to communicate with you regularly so that we can help you as things arise so we can, give you relief as quickly as possible. So your needs will change throughout treatment, and a lot of it has to do with as more exposure to treatment, for example, with radiation, changes can start to transpire. This is very normal. This is a very expected thing to have happen. The thing that isn't always known by your practitioner is that the rate of changes that can occur or the severity. So it's very important for us to be communicating with you throughout the treatment process. A dietitian is on your team. It's part of your healthcare team. And what a dietitian can do is help you with giving you information on modifying your diet, potentially modifying the texture, even the foods that you're consuming to make it more comfortable for you, and helping you meet your nutrition goals. Now, at times there's conversations about a feeding tube, which is sometimes part of the treatment plan, and it's nothing to be afraid of or concerned about. I know there's a lot of patients I have that come through who have a kind of opinions or experiences around feeding tubes based on their exposure with maybe a loved one or a friend. But with this type of treatment, we use the feeding tube as a bridge, as a support, to help you meet your fluid and hydration needs, and even being able to provide yourself medications at times, just if you're having difficulties with swallowing some of them. So when you don't need the feeding tube anymore, it's removed, so it's not a long-term or forever thing, and you can continue to eat while having a feeding tube. Some people don't realize that. So some things that I just want to point out with patients when they're going through treatment or about to go through treatment is that our goal for you is to avoid weight loss, to make sure that you're staying hydrated, and to address your side effects as they arise as quickly as possible. Now, I have some patients who are like, oh, I could stand to lose a few pounds, but going through cancer treatment is not the time for weight loss. There can be actually more of a loss of lean muscle mass, and it can impact your ability to do the things you enjoy because it can impact your endurance. It can also increase your risk of falls and delay wound healing, and it can just result in just lesser quality of life, not being able to do the things that you want to do. So even if you're overweight, you can still become malnourished. After treatment's done, we can start talking about any goals you have related to weight changes, but until then, we just want to focus on maintaining where you are or maybe even fortifying where you are. So hydration is something that's left off the list sometimes. I know I mentioned it a minute ago, but we focus so much on calories and what you're eating that nutrition, sometimes that we forget the conversation about hydration, and hydration is really important, especially during head and neck cancer therapy. Most people who aren't eating well are typically not drinking well, and dehydration can cause a whole set of complications on its own, such as dizziness, fatigue, issues with a lot of different things. It can even make some of the side effects more pronounced, such as difficulties with drier mouth, and so hydrating throughout the day is really important. But most people need around 8 to 10 8-ounce glasses of fluid a day. A fluid is something that is such as water, milk, fruit juice, things like that. Some people like Gatorade. There are some tips we can provide if you are having changes in taste, such as rinsing your mouth to help with that. There are medications to help with pain, with swallowing. So as you talk with your healthcare team, these things can be brought to your attention to help support you. I'm going to go ahead and hand the line back over to our conference leader. And just remember, the dietitian's part of the healthcare team. Please ask to reach out to them so they can help you as quickly as possible. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Ms. Bearden, for that stellar presentation. Thank you so much again. And our next speaker is Ms. Amanda Hollinger. And Ms. Hollinger is Executive Director of Head and Neck Cancer Alliance, who we are partnering with today on this call. We are grateful to have them here and have this continued partnership. And Ms. Hollinger will be discussing Head and Neck Cancer Alliance's free programs and services and how to get in contact with them through their phone number, website, and email. It is now my great pleasure to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Ms. Hollinger.
Hello, thank you so much, and thank you to all the wonderful speakers that have gone before me on this program. We really appreciate the partnership and the opportunity to be here today. The Head and Neck Cancer Alliance is a nonprofit organization, and our mission is to provide hope and support to individuals affected by head and neck cancer, to also raise awareness about prevention and early detection, and to advocate for improved patient outcomes. So we have a number of programs to support patients as well as caregivers. These include peer-to-peer mentorship, an online support community that has about 10,000 plus active members. We also feature Ask the Expert topics on that community where you can engage with medical experts on various facets related to the head and neck cancer journey. We also offer some limited financial assistance. We have ongoing educational webinars. We also have a survivorship symposium that's really focused on long-term side effects and life after head and neck cancer treatment. And that symposium is offered both in person as well as virtually. So we really invite you to join us in that from anywhere all over the country. This year, that event will be on July 18th in Boston or online. I also invite you to join us for our next webinar, which is June 1st, and that is going to be a great panel discussing the first year after head and neck cancer diagnosis and navigating all that comes with that. So please join us, engage with some of our great medical experts and survivors on that topic. In addition, we have a patient resource navigator that you can call or you can email to ask questions, seek support, or just be connected to resources in your area. Additionally, our website has a great deal of content about head and neck cancer, including educational videos, and you can search by topic. We have a searchable recipe index, nutrition information, and more. So you can learn more about any of those programs and sign up for them. Join our e-newsletter, which comes out once a month and tells you what's happening. And that is available at our website, www.headandneck.org. And head and neck is all spelled out. Or you can email us at info@headandneck.org. Thank you again so much for the opportunity to share more about the Head and Neck Cancer Alliance and our programs today.
Thank you so much, Ms. Hollinger, for that great overview of all that you offer at Head and Neck Cancer Alliance. It's a wonderful resource for our participants. I do encourage everyone to check them out. And our next speaker is Ms. Victoria Puzo. And Ms. Puzo is an oncology social worker and support group program director here at Cancer Care. And Ms. Puzo will be discussing Cancer Care's free programs and services as well as our Hope Line and website. It is now my great pleasure to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Ms. Puzo.
Thanks, Johnny, for that wonderful introduction, and good afternoon, everyone. Cancer Care is a national nonprofit organization providing free professional support services and information to help people manage the emotional, practical, and financial challenges of cancer. Our comprehensive services include resource navigation, counseling and support groups, educational workshops such as the one you're participating in today, printed publications, and limited financial assistance. I'm going to be talking a little bit more in depth about some of these programs, but just know if you ever want to become connected to any of Cancer Care's free services, you can call our National Hope Line to speak to an oncology social worker, and the phone number is 1-800-813-4673. And I just want to take a moment to, talk about the fact that an oral head or neck cancer diagnosis can be very overwhelming. Additional support and guidance, as well as establishing a support network, may be helpful to relieve feelings of anxiety related to your diagnosis or being a caregiver to your loved one. I think some of the presenters today, did a great job just talking about how this type of diagnosis impacts every part of someone, your physical well-being, your emotional well-being, your identity, and everything. So it can be beneficial to determine ways to approach these challenges that may surface throughout your diagnosis and beyond. Working one-on-one with someone like an oncology social worker or a therapist, engaging in individual counseling or support groups can offer a space to express one's feelings, emotions, and concerns. And if you are in need of emotional support as a patient or a caregiver, please feel free to reach out to our Hope Line and we can explore your options for support, whether it's through our programs or through any of the other programs like the Head and Neck Cancer Alliance that spoke about their programs as well. In addition, Cancer Care's resource navigation services are offered nationally to patients, post-treatment survivors, and caregivers affected by cancer. We offer a short-term, strengths-based approach to resource navigation where a social worker or navigator will work with a client in connecting them to resources, referrals, and financial assistance. Whether you're in need of practical, financial, or emotional support, our navigators can help provide you with resources to meet your needs. And lastly, Cancer Care's website, which is cancercare.org, there's a wide array of reading material and information related to oral, head, and neck cancers. This includes recorded Connect education workshops, Cancer Out Loud, the Cancer Care podcast, publications about coping with your diagnosis or your role as a caregiver, as well as stories of help and hope, among many other resources. I hope the information that you learned here today is helpful. Please, you know, again, feel free to reach out to us if you have additional questions after the workshop is over, and I'll pass it back to our host, Johnny, to wrap things up and bring us to our Q&A.
Thank you so much, Ms. Puzo, for that comprehensive overview of all that we offer here at Cancer Care. And now we're going to move on to the Q&A. I'm going to ask Bella to explain to you how to queue up for questions.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, at this time, we will take questions from the web only. You may submit questions by clicking Ask a Question.
Thank you. Okay, and our first question here for Ms. Puzo. Do you have any recommendations or tips for looking for resources online, specifically something credible for my diagnosis?
Yes. So this can be really complicated. If you try to Google resources, you want to be really careful of not, you know, going into anything that isn't a credible source or isn't a reliable organization to engage with. So one thing that you might want to do is finding something that's .gov or .org. Those will usually have the most accurate information. And you can also, using Cancer Care, calling our Hope Line, we try to vet all of the resources that we provide to people. So, you know, our database of resources will include credible resources to either get information or find financial assistance and things like that. But I think mainly finding those resources that are .gov, .org, or .edu have the most credible information provided. And any information that you do find, you can always bring back to your medical professional and, you know, double check with them about what you're reading and making sure that those things are accurate.
Thank you so much, Ms. Puzo, for that answer. Okay. Well, due to time, we're just going to do our takeaways from our speakers. So we're actually going to start with Ms. Hollinger and then Ms. Puzo. So Ms. Hollinger, if you could just provide a one-minute takeaway for our participants.
Absolutely. Thank you so much. I mean, I think from my perspective as a national nonprofit, we are really here to support head and neck cancer patients, and we know that often we hear from people that they feel very alone after a diagnosis. They may not know anyone else that has had this particular diagnosis, and we really want everyone to take away and leave from here knowing that they are not alone, that there are a lot of people out there and support and resources, and that we are there for you.
Thank you so much, Ms. Hollinger. And Ms. Puzo?
Yeah, I second that for sure. It was almost exactly what I was thinking as well. But, you know, and even just knowing that it's not uncommon to, you know, struggle with either the emotional, financial, or physical impact of your diagnosis, and asking for help is really a strength. There are organizations like ours there to provide that type of support and to give maybe even just a little bit of extra guidance or a listening ear so that you feel a little bit more like grounded and supported as you deal with this really challenging thing. So just, you know, don't be afraid to reach out for help.
Great. Thank you so much, Ms. Pujo. And now I just want to take a moment to thank all of our speakers. This has been a phenomenal panel today. It's been some time since we've last done this program, so I think this is the best time that we've done this program since. Heard a lot of updates from our presenters today. And I do want to say a few words, though, for our participants, for those of you that didn't have your question answered or that did ask a question and have your question answered. I would like you to go back to your healthcare team and then ask them your questions. Please remember that you've learned a great deal from today's program, so I want you to take what you've learned and go back to your treating healthcare team and ask your question again and again. And lastly, I just want to echo what Ms. Hollinger said. I don't want anyone to leave this workshop feeling as if they are alone, because you are not alone. You have a community of support here at Cancer Care, as well as the Head and Neck Cancer Alliance. We are here for you. Okay, so, and I appreciate everyone's participation today, and I want to wish you all a very fine day. Thank you so much.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This completes the workshop, and you may now disconnect. Everyone, have a great day.